Welcome back to My Radio at stanpelke.com. Hello again. I'm Stan Pelke, your host at My Radio. Thanks for joining me for the fifth podcast in my series of readings from my original science fiction novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. This program includes two sections, Interlude 1 and the first half of Chapter 3. Hold on, you're in for a few surprises today. Please check back soon for new content and additional podcasts. Interlude 1. Translucent cylindrical containers, each 25 centimeters in diameter, 1 meter long, stacked in bundles of 9, 3 containers wide, 3 containers deep. Each cylindrical container fastened to one before and one after, kilometer upon kilometer. The empty space around the bundle 1.5 meters in all directions. Then smooth concrete and steel walls in each direction, forming a perfectly square-shaped tunnel. No sunlight. Artificial illumination cast by a million tiny, iridescent, blinking orbs embedded in the cold, smooth walls. Not a whisper of movement of air in the pressurized space. Shadows slide through the translucent cylinders in regular intervals of time. The low, regular, pulsing throb of energy coursing through the orbs, joined by the sound of friction movement in the containers in a slower but equally regular tempo. The sound from the orbs and the sound from the cylinder shadows interlock on every 11th iteration of the pulsing orb lights. The space. Cold. Every 400th pulse of the orb lights, small hatches in the steel and concrete open near every 15th cylinder. Small mechanical probes emerge from dark interiors to scan cylinders. Temperature, pressure, internal chemical balances, enzyme reaction rates, growth factors, bacterial contamination levels. Probes click summary readings to each other. Necessary adjustments are made. Probes retreat to their holding areas. Orb lights flash another 400 pulses. The space. Cold. Every 2,800th pulse of the orb lights, small hatches in the steel and concrete open near every 15th cylinder. Small spheroids emerge from dark interiors to scan the pulsing orbs. Orbs that no longer pulse, replaced. Small spheroids click summary results to each other. Necessary replacements for future use are distributed to holding areas. Small spheroids retreat to their holding areas. Orb lights flash another 2,800 pulses. The space, cold. Every 400th pulse of the orb lights, small hatches in the steel and concrete open near every 15th cylinder. Small mechanical probes emerge from dark interiors to scan cylinders. Temperature, pressure, internal chemical balances, enzyme reaction rates, growth factors, bacterial contamination levels. Probes click summary readings to each other. Necessary adjustments are made. Probes retreat to their holding areas. Orb lights flash another 400 pulses. The space. Cold. Shadows slide through the translucent cylinders in regular intervals of time. The low, irregular, pulsing throb of energy coursing through the orbs, joined by the shadow of friction movement in the containers in a slower but equally regular tempo. The sound from the orbs and the sound from the cylinder shadows interlock on every 11th iteration of the pulsing orb lights. Their polyrhythmic white noise numbs consciousness with a blank sensory wash. Translucent cylindrical containers, each 25 centimeters in diameter, 1 meter long, stacked in bundles of 9, 3 containers wide, 3 containers deep. Each cylindrical container fastened to one before and one after, kilometer upon kilometer. The space around the bundle, 1.5 meters in all directions, then smooth concrete and steel walls in each direction, forming a perfectly square-shaped tunnel. No sunlight. Artificial illumination cast by a million tiny iridescent blinking orbs embedded in the cold, smooth walls. Not a whisper of movement of air in the pressurized space. Chapter 3. The Beast in the Woods. He woke with a start. The night had grown cold, and the fire near his feet had burned low. He reached for a few small pieces of wood to toss onto the glowing embers, convinced that it had only been the cold that woke him. And then the second blood-curdling scream shattered the stillness of the night. Knife Priest's mind began to clear, and he tried to fathom the meaning of the commotion from the muffled but anxious voices that he could hear as others began to gather beyond the carved wooden door of his dwelling. Bright Sparrow, resting on the bed beside him, stirred. Her warm hand brushed against his bare arm. Her touch was soft and reassuring, and for a moment his thoughts were only of her. He would lie back down beside her, warmed by desire. He would touch her, kiss her. Then the scream tore the night apart again, and again, and again.
There's something in the woods.
Someone began to pound on the wooden door, and a muffled voice called his name.
Telkortoran! Telkortoran, wake up!
The pounding continued as Telkortoran, the knife priest, rose from the low wooden bed and moved carefully in the dim light to the door. He slid the large wooden latch out of its brackets, and with his right foot, he pushed aside the heavy stone standing against the door. As he opened it, Knife Priest was met by Second Fist's scarred and bearded face, which was illuminated by the moonlight outside and the fire's embers inside.
Telkortoran, you are needed at the Gathering Rock. There's a blood beast in the woods. It's taken First Fist's daughter.
Soon everyone in the village was awake, and the sound of weeping began to fill the cold night air. Knife Priest nodded that he understood, then pushed the door shut again. He moved swiftly to the large wooden chest across the room from the bed and pulled out his ceremonial hunting clothing. A blood beast here, this far from the mountain! Awandor, his bright sparrow, had risen from the bed and was quickly but carefully producing tiny carved wooden boxes from an alcove in the stone slab wall. She carried these over to a low-lying wooden workbench beside a large clay pot filled with water. She began to mix the contents of the boxes into a wooden bowl into which she slowly ladled some of the water. "I have heard the old men speak of such things before," Knife Priest replied. He stepped around the fire pit that was dug into the ground in the center of the room and approached the sacred shrine in the right-hand back corner of the house, closest to their bed. Knife Priest pushed aside several animal pelts that covered the intricately carved shrine and reached for his best polished flint blade. It was the last knife he still possessed that he had crafted under his grandfather's tutelage, and it was his most sacred. It was the knife he had wielded when he killed the great antlered king deer two harvests ago, as the creature had burst out of the brush beside him in the deep woods to the south of the harvest encampment. It was the blade he'd used to slay his bitter rival for his place in First Fist's magisterium. He would trust no other knife tonight. Talcor Torin turned it gently this way and that, mesmerized as reflected firelight slid across its smooth surface and sharp edges. As his mind turned inward under the spell of the blade, Knife Priest whispered incantations and blessings over it and lifted it upward toward the smoke hole and the stars high above. Awandor joined Talcor Torin, though she spoke no more words. She did not want to risk breaking the spells he was casting. She gently pulled his tunic aside and smeared the brightly colored paste she had prepared over his chest and shoulders, humming her own spells and incantations for protection and foresight as her hands moved across his body. They had been unnerved by the screams in the night, but now the two were drawn together in a mystical embrace as she touched him and they whispered to their gods. Her hands lingered near his neck. She reached up and kissed his lips, then continued applying her magic to his sides and back. The paste finally and completely applied, Bright Sparrow tied his tunic back in place, then helped him into a second, shorter tunic to which she had sewn several stout leather pieces she had fashioned a year ago for extra protection against the claws and teeth of wild animals. Finally, Bright Sparrow strapped her dead father's prized quiver across her husband's broad back. Knife Priest was not a trained archer, so instead of arrows, Bright Sparrow carefully placed six stout pieces of wood, each nearly 2 feet long and wickedly sharpened at one end, into the quiver. Lastly, and with deep reverence, she set a sharpened portion of the king's deer's antlers among the wooden stakes. "You will need those if the stone blade is lost in battle tonight," she whispered into his ear. Bright Sparrow then blessed Knife Priest's cloak that she had made from the king deer's hide and wrapped it over his shoulders, fastening it with the four carved bare-bone clasps she had meticulously carved as one of her wedding gifts to him. They paused for a moment and looked deeply into each other's eyes. In that moment, Talcor Torin longed for Awandor more intensely than he had for many months. Then their private spell was broken as more shouting burst out in front of their dwelling. They spoke a final incantation for luck and kissed quickly before Knife Priest pulled the door open again and tore out into the night to join the other hunters preparing to storm the darkness. The stone slab house that Knife Priest and Bright Sparrow shared was set into the uppermost portion of the bank of a small river that ran through the southern edge of the village. Half of the house was buried into the bank itself, while the rest jutted out onto a wide ledge that had been cut away generations earlier. The door opened onto a pathway that had been worn down in the middle of the ledge by countless feet passing this way and that, and it ran among the dozen stone slab houses in the bank, then down to the fishing pools and boat jetties in the river below. The rest of the village dwellings stood above, on a narrow stretch of flat land between the riverbank and the deep forest behind the village. The village's priestly families and master craftsmen had long occupied the dwellings in the riverbank. The newer dwellings above and behind were dominated by the great house of the First Fist and were built of carefully latticed wood branches covered in mud. Several old women were stoking the fires and preparing torches in the center of the upper village beside the gathering stone. A number of men and women had already arrived and were seated along the low-lying stone wall that formed the barrier between the village and the inner sacred circle with the gathering stone as its focal point. Knife Priest joined them, nodding here, speaking softly there, but not yet beginning the ritual of the hunt. Bright Sparrow emerged from their stone dwelling with more of her colored paste and made her way up the path along the riverbank and then along the pebble and shell-covered walkway into the heart of the village. With the help of several village mothers, she began applying her magic to the bodies of 14 or 15 younger boys. They were not yet old enough to wield true weapons, but they would bear wooden clubs and torches for their warrior fathers, brothers, and uncles during the night's hunt. Several young girls, apprentices to Bright Sparrow, now appeared, dressed in heavy garments to protect against the chilly night. Guided by quiet words from Awandor, they began to sing blessings for the young hearts of their brothers and cousins. Armed with knife and flame and the magic of ritual blessings applied by their womenfolk, the men and boys of the village rose from their seats along the stone wall and gathered to stand expectantly in front of their knife priest. Telkor Torin nodded his approval once more, then began to shout out one of the most potent sacred hunting songs as he lifted his arms over them. Knife Priest's strong voice tamed the tension in the village. As his melody soared above the crackling fire and rising ash and smoke, and his rhythms leapt into every heart, nerves were calmed and anxious hearts were stilled. This was the power of Telkor Torin the Knife Priest, the supreme warrior priest in the village. As the Knife Priest's song faded, the hunters were finally joined by the hulking figure that was First Fist, guarded as always by his nearly as large mother's sister's son, Second Fist. First Fist grasped Knife Priest's shoulders, held him at arm's length for a moment, then embraced him quickly.
"Tonight, Knife Priest, you will lead the hunt. There is dark magic in the woods, and I trust no one else to guide us through it."
"I obey your word, my lord," Knife Priest replied, nodding his assent. The whole company was now assembled and arrayed in appropriate ranks. First Fist turned to speak to a group of young men who had followed him from his central dwelling.
"Yan Koben, take your brothers across the water and guard the fields. Make certain that there are no enemy awaiting our departure to come down upon the village and steal and kill."
"As you command, my lord." Yan Koben, the eldest nephew of First Fist's second wife, raised his spear above his head as a salute to their master, then grunted an order to six other young men and boys who followed him across the sacred space, down the village way, and over the narrow footbridge that led across the river to the village's cornfields. First Fist then ordered three of the older boys from the village to stand guard over the village's livestock pens.
"All is ready now,"
First Fist said to Telkor Torin. Knife Priest gave the general order, then led the Battle Brothers down the village way in the opposite direction from the river, and finally into the deeper darkness beneath the canopy of the trees that formed the leading edge of the great forest to the north of the village. The flames of the village boys' torches drove patches of darkness back, and Knife Priest ordered the village's two most skilled sign readers to his side to study the broken twigs and faint footprints and to confirm the direction they should take. Beside the side readers, to their left, were Knife Priest's two senior apprentices, defending his left flank as was their sacred right and duty. Each bore spears with heavy stone tips Telkor Torin himself had crafted. Behind them came a group of eight young warriors. Three of them were Knife Priest's junior apprentices. All were sworn friends of Telkor Torin's senior apprentices, and thus by tradition took up fighting positions near them. Directly behind Telkor Torin was Bright Sparrow's younger brother, Kirwindor. The whole group, apprentices, friends, and brother by marriage, formed Knife Priest's extended household guard and marked him as one of the most senior men in the village. He knew each by both their public names and their secret names. He had fed them, hunted with them, trained with them. Two had been close friends to his now-dead rival, but he had chosen to embrace them rather than push them out of the circle he had partly built and partly inherited. None were as close to him as were his two senior apprentices and Kirwindor, though he trusted them all. To Knife Priest's right was First Fist, guarded by his two sons, as well as Second Fist, and Second Fist's three sons and their closest peers. First Fist's youngest son and the two youngest of Second Fist bore clubs and torches. Further to their right was a small cluster of older boys who were training with Second Fist. One or two of them might soon join First Fist's inner circle. Several had been armed that night with spears rather than clubs. Behind this group were some eight or nine warriors, none distinguished, but all extremely loyal to First Fist and his family. Behind the extended households of First Fist and Knife Priest
came the rest of the village warriors, 30 or so more men. Most were young, some were at their prime, a few were now quite old. 3 were respected healers. 5 others served as priests of the village's minor cults. 2 were gifted singers of stories, though neither had knife priest's foresight nor his craftsman's training. Another was the best boatwright the village had had in 2 generations. Some of these men were village elders, rare survivors of past magisteria and of succession purges. A few might have wanted to have been first fist, but could never have bested their current chief. Most were more skilled at the planting and the harvesting than at the hunting and fighting, yet they had obeyed the summons that night. By the nature of these things, none of these men were close to the two fists nor to knife priest, though Telkor Torin bore none of them ill will. As they moved further into the woods, Telkor Torin's strong baritone voice regularly burst out over the party, invoking the good fortune of the wood spirit and the sharp sight of the owl matron. He was especially sure to invoke the owl matron whenever the sign readers paused to consider the right path. Although Knife Priest cared little for the songs of the Blood Fang God and was not particularly devoted to that spirit, he nevertheless sang his songs too. They honored First Fist's patron god, and it was Knife Priest's duty to pay homage and seek the blessings of the Old One on behalf of First Fist. For those songs, Knife Priest's voice dropped low into his most gravelly range as he imitated the timbre of rolling rocks and spitting fire. These songs hovered on the edge of dark magic, and Telkor Torin's heart felt chilled, and his breath seemed to catch in his throat as he struggled to speak the foreign words of those songs. For a moment or two, his mind wandered into the haze of his own song-induced trance. Another scream cracked open the darkness to their left, toward the gorge. It interrupted the songs to the Old One and yanked Knife Priest back into the present. The party of men and boys turned like a flock of geese and lunged toward the dread-filled sound. They soon passed the marker stones that warned of the approaching cliff's edge and Bloodfang's rarely used great altar. Why had the blood beast drawn them this way, past this great stone altar hidden in the woods? Knife Priest burst into his most complex songs as they passed the altar. Words that he could barely fathom about cosmic battles fought long ages ago passed his lips and filled the stuffy night air between the trees that leaned menacingly over them. The hunting party had barely gone another 20 feet when the night-drenched forest erupted with the sound of guardian wolves howling all around them. Several of the men toward the rear cried out in shock and fear. They all stopped as one. Kirwindor moved within a pace or two of the knife priest. Telkor Torin readied his sacred blade and also reached with his left hand for the king deer's antler. Just as First Fist turned to his right to give an order to Second Fist, a dozen guardian wolves sprang out of the shadows and lunged at the hunters. 3 of the largest brutes dashed directly at First Fist and Knife Priest. It took Telkor Torin only a split second to plant his feet, square his shoulders, and prepare to strike with knife and sharpened antler. Even now he readied a song of fierce resistance. Knife Priest was suddenly wet with blood. Things had moved quickly, and he had been barely conscious of the long-practiced, death-inflicting movements he had made. Looking down at his hands, he saw that a wolf had leaped at him only to meet the sacred blade, which Knife Priest had thrust into its mouth and through the back of its skull while impaling the beast's side with the king deer antler. Kirwindor had plunged his spear into the side of another beast and was just now slitting its throat with his own stone knife. Telkor Torin left the antler in the monster who had leaped for his neck, but he swiftly recovered his sacred blade. Only then did he realize that all had not gone well. Although there were now 7 dead or dying guardian wolves among the trees, the villagers had not come through unscathed. 2 boys had been badly mauled to the rear of the group. 1 older hunter had been overwhelmed by 2 wolves and killed. The boatwright was missing, probably dragged away by 1 or 2 wolves when the pack lost too many of its members. First Fist ritually spat on the nearest wolf corpse, which Second Fist had killed.
You stay with the boys till we return. tend them as best you can. You and you, guard the old one with reverence. Do not let the beasts return to eat his flesh. Everyone else, follow Knife Priest.
What of the boat, right? They dragged him off that way. First Fist squinted into the darkness in the direction in which three of the elders were pointing. He shook his head.
A great loss, but we cannot stumble into the darkness to be trapped or hunted down in ever smaller and smaller groups. The rest of us remain together and move forward.
This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.